It's time for Valley Writers Read, a production of Valley Public Radio featuring the talents of writers from Central California. Here's the host of our program, Franz Weinschenk.
Good evening, friends. Thank you for joining us on Valley Writers Read. Tonight, a story by a local writer whose background is grounded in the Mennonite tradition. His name is Larry Warkentine, and he was born in Reedley. The story he's brought with him is entitled A Coat of Many Patches, and he tells us it is taken from his father's experiences many years ago back in the Midwest. So here's Larry Warkentine reading A Coat of Many Patches.
Suddenly, Dad shouted, "Lieber Gott, ein Zug!" We had just finished the repair work on the Cimarron overcrossing and were still in the center of the railroad trestle with a 30-foot drop to the dry riverbed beneath us. Dad never spoke German on the job, but the shock of seeing a plume of smoke approaching the bridge made him revert to his first language. It didn't matter what he said. Hank and I both knew by his tone of voice that we were in deep trouble. We jumped on our hand car. Dad and I pumped one side of the handles, and Hank worked the other. This couldn't be happening. We had cleared everything with the station master. The next train wasn't due until 6 o'clock. It took a few seconds to get the repair car moving. I was facing the oncoming train. The dark smoke was belching out of the engine like a billowing storm cloud. It was already on the far end of the bridge.
"Faster! Don't look at the train!" Dad demanded.
I couldn't help looking. I knew how powerful those engines could be, and it was getting bigger and bigger. It was like one of those bad dreams where no matter how fast you run, the terrible monster always stays within grabbing distance. The roar of the engine drowned out my thoughts. The silvered headlight stared at us like the eye of Cyclops. The monster teeth of the cowcatcher were ready to tear us apart. The massive black arms that drove the huge wheels were almost a blur. They made our pumping arms seem hopelessly puny.
"Jump!"
Dad screamed, just as the metal teeth bit into the edge of the cart.
"Jump!"
he demanded again as I hesitated. Our bodies sailed through the air. Water from the tank splashed over us as we flew. The shrill screech of churning wheels against metal tracks and the ear-deafening blast of the train whistle added to the sheer terror of the moment. I anticipated the impact of my body smashing against the dry riverbed. I didn't want to survive as an invalid. What would Mom do with 6 children and no one to help? Why had I lied about my age to get this job? The family needed food, even if I was only 15. Dad had lost the farm on Black Tuesday when the bottom fell out of the wheat market. Now we were losing our lives. Time stood still in the chaos of smoke and wheels and screams. This was the end. But we survived. We had almost made it to the end of the bridge and had fallen only 3 feet to the sloping banks. The unscheduled freight train stopped a few hundred yards down the track. The engineer came back to check on us. He was horrified, and I don't think we were his first concern. If his train had come an hour earlier, he would now be crushed in a pile of twisted metal. Apparently, the telegraph message announcing this train had not reached our station master. Our cart was laying in a tangled mass alongside the tracks. Once the engineer calmed down, he offered us a ride to the train yard in Dalhart. The station master was angry at everyone because of the accident, and in his fury, he discovered that I was underage.
"You're fired," he screamed. "Don't ever come back here again. We don't hire kids."
I may have been a kid, but I knew I had to help the family.
Some of the railroad workers had told us that there was work in New Mexico. A few days after our narrow escape, I made up my mind to give New Mexico a try. After Dad left for work, I told Mom my plan. I would catch the freight train to Albuquerque. She cried, but she didn't argue. She gave me some food to take along and reminded me to take my winter coat, since the September air was turning cold. Over the years, she had patched the elbows and lengthened the sleeves, yet it would keep me warm. "I'll send money home," I told her. "I love you." She sobbed, "Peter, Peter, Gott segne dir." She knew I preferred my American name, Pete, but her heart always spoke German. Her final words, "God bless you," made me think of Jacob blessing Joseph as he went out in his coat of many colors to bring food to his brothers. There was a train at 11 a.m., and I had worked around the yard long enough to know where I could jump on without being seen. At 11:05, I spotted an open boxcar. The train was already moving when I threw my small bundle of clothes aboard. I grabbed the edge of the door and let the momentum of the train swing me into the car.
"You're kind of young to be riding the rails," a voice said from the shadows of the boxcar.
"Old enough," I replied.
"Where are you headed?" the voice continued.
"Albuquerque," I said with confidence. "I hear they have work there."
"Oh, they have work there. But the problem is they don't have pay," the voice said with a chuckle.
"Do you have a name?" I asked as my eyes began to adjust to the shadows.
"They call me Mo," the voice replied.
I could see now that Mo was a bearded man who looked to be about 50 years old. He wore a heavy wool overcoat that seemed to surround him like a dark storm cloud. There were some torn places where the clouds parted enough to show a red plaid shirt underneath. From the looks of his matted hair and dirty face, he had probably been on the road for weeks.
"You want a smoke?"
He offered me a crushed pack of Camels.
"Sure," I said.
I had watched Hank smoke while we worked on the rails, and I figured that if I was going to be a hobo, I had better learn to act like one. I remembered how Tom Sawyer nearly choked the first time he tried to smoke. I was smart. I only puffed and didn't inhale until I felt comfortable. I don't think Mo ever suspected that this was my first cigarette. We talked for a while and then both dozed off. I hadn't slept much the night before, and Mo said he hadn't had a decent night's sleep in weeks. When we woke up, the train was pulling into Tucumcari. I was hungry. I pulled out an apple and a few Tweebach from my pack. I offered one to Mo.
"What's this? It's as hard as a rock," he complained.
"It's a Reiche Tweebach, a twice-baked bread roll. You've got to eat it slowly. Just nibble off a corner and let it soften up in your mouth. Of course it's better with coffee or milk, but as they say, beggars can't be choosers." I had often quoted that old saying, but this time it took on new meaning. I really was a beggar. Everything in the world that I owned was in my bag. I realized that in my hurry to leave, I hadn't planned very wisely. I didn't have a single penny. I pulled my coat around me and stuffed my hands in the pockets to keep warm. Something metallic and cold touched my right hand. There, in my hand, were $3 silver. I hadn't seen Mom put them in the coat pocket,
but I knew they came from the cookie jar above the stove where she kept her egg money.
"You want a drink?"
Mo asked, holding out a clear glass bottle which he had taken from his coat pocket. "What is it?" I asked, hesitating.
"Moonshine whiskey," he replied.
This was no time to be prissy. I didn't want to put my lips on his dirty bottle, and I had no idea what whiskey tasted like, but I was not going to chicken out now. I tipped the bottle back and took a big swallow. I was not prepared for what followed. My throat burned. My stomach felt like it was on fire. I sputtered and tried to spit some of it out, but it was too late. Mo laughed.
"Just wait a few seconds, and it will feel good. It will help keep you warm through the night."
He was right, and so was my mom. That winter coat felt mighty good. Throughout the night, just as I dozed off, the train would slow down for some small town, and the connectors between the cars would slam against each other and make a terrible noise. There was no way I could stay asleep. Early the next morning, Mo stirred me from half-sleep.
"We're just about there. Grab your stuff and get ready to jump. Just a mile outside the train yard, we're going to slow for a corner. That's where we say farewell to the Albuquerque special."
I was glad to have a veteran traveler to help me out. I knew we would probably never see each other again, but I was glad that Mo had been with me for those first nights of my adventure. We jumped, and Mo took a nasty spill. I could see that hoboing was not well suited for a 50-year-old. We walked along together about halfway to town, and then he turned off toward a cluster of wooden shanties where other men had gathered around warm fires.
"This is home for me in Albuquerque," he said. "Good luck."
I wished him good luck, and we parted. I headed along the tracks toward the center of town. Albuquerque was the biggest town I had ever seen. It must have stretched at least 2 miles along the main street.
"This here is Highway 66, boy. It runs clean across this country from the Carolinas to California. Where are you from?"
announced a voice that was almost as big as the belly from which it emerged.
Oklahoma,
I squeaked in surprise. "Oklahoma," I repeated, trying to make my voice sound deep and confident.
"You're looking for work? I guess I don't need to ask. Everybody is looking for work these days. I'm Jess Hawkins. What's your name?"
Pete Wiebe," I replied.
"Wiebe? What kind of weird name is that? Never heard such a name before. It sure ain't Irish or Mexican,"
Jess continued derisively. "It's a Dutch name." I figured that was the safest answer. I didn't want to say German because of the war, and I never thought of myself as Russian, even though Mom had been born there.
"You just get to town?" he persisted.
"Yep, I'm looking for work. Do you know where I could find a job that pays?" I said hopefully.
"Well, ain't this our lucky day," he announced in a voice that sounded like he was running for mayor. "I'm looking for a young man with strong arms who could split about 50 cords of firewood I got stacked out on my place."
I had struck it rich on my first day. Being on my own wasn't going to be so bad after all.
"I'm young and I'm strong and I know how to swing an axe. I've spent the last year driving spikes on the railroad. I'm the man for your job. When can I start and how much does it pay?"
$5 a cord plus room and board. My Sally is a good cook, and we have a bunk out in the barn. I want it all split and stacked before we have snow. So you can start tomorrow if that suits you. I'll meet you right here by the bank building tomorrow at 10 a.m. My place is just a few miles out of town.
Thanks, Mr. Hawkins. I know you won't be disappointed with my work, I called to him as he started his car and drove away. I wandered down some back streets until I saw an old building that had a sign in the window advertising, Bed, $1 per night. It certainly wasn't a fancy place. It was a large room with mattresses down each side of a central aisle. I was tired, and I really didn't want to talk to anyone. That seemed to be all right with most everybody there. As the sun set, the room got quiet, except for a few late arrivals, who stumbled from bed to bed until they found an empty mattress. The night air was cooler than I had expected, but my coat kept me warm enough. I quietly munched the last food in my pack. Tomorrow, I would buy breakfast, and by noon, I would meet Jess Hawkins. Seeing all of these men made me realize how lucky I was to have found work so quickly. I slept soundly, and only remember waking a few times when someone stumbled against my mattress as he made his way to the outhouse in the backyard. Long before noon, I was waiting in front of the bank. I was beginning to worry that Mr. Hawkins wouldn't show up. But right on the dot, there he was. I waved just in case he had forgotten what I looked like, and I got in his car as he stopped. I'd never seen such a fine car. It was a 1927 Chevrolet. It had glass windows and smooth upholstered seats. It was much nicer than our old Model T back home. Mr. Hawkins talked about his ranch and the plans he had for expanding. He was such a colorful talker that I paid little attention to the passing countryside. It seemed like only a few minutes before he turned off the narrow country road onto a long drive that led into a forested area. About a mile or two down this drive, we came to a farmyard with a small house and several barns. He introduced me to his wife. She was rather young to be married to such an old, overweight man as Mr. Hawkins. She had shoulder-length black hair loosely tied under a scarf. She wore a dress that was printed with small flowers. It fit her tightly, and it was apparent that she had a good figure.
"This is Pete. He's going to be living out here for a while. He's going to split our firewood," he told his wife.
"Nice to meet you, ma'am," I nodded.
"Once you get settled down, come on in for some lunch," she said.
Those were welcome words to a boy who wasn't sure where his next meal was coming from. Mr. Hawkins showed me to the small shed where I would be sleeping. There was a cot and a small cupboard. Otherwise, the room could have been a chicken coop, which is what it was probably built for. I put my stuff in the shed, washed up at the hand pump, and went back to the house. Mrs. Hawkins saw me coming and pushed the door open.
"I'll bet you're hungry. I'll take care of that right away," she said with a laugh.
I liked her from the start. I wasn't so sure about Mr. Hawkins. He always talked like he was putting on a show. I never knew if he was telling the truth or just trying to impress me. He joined us for lunch. They didn't pray before the meal. I had never sat at a table without someone saying a prayer of thanks. Oh, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, I thought to myself. Even though I didn't bow my head or close my eyes, I couldn't help thinking a prayer.
"After lunch, I'll take you out to the wood stack," Mr. Hawkins announced.
He always sounded like he was speaking to a large crowd of people, even when he talked to his wife. I really didn't care. This was a good job, and I knew I could do it. At least for the next few months, I wouldn't have to worry about food or a place to sleep.
"Ready for some tough work?" Mr.
Hawkins announced as we walked down a path through the trees.
"You bet!"
I assured him. "Here it is," he said with a broad swing of his arm. This was no woodpile. This was an Egyptian pyramid. This was Mount Everest. They must have cleared half of New Mexico to create a pile this huge. "You sure this is only going to make 50 cords of split wood?" I said incredulously.
"Give or take a few," he replied. "We got all the trees from the new spur line that Santa Fe is laying. I expect I'll have some to sell to folks in Albuquerque. Here's a couple of axes, and over there's a grind wheel. You may need to sharpen an axe or two before you finish. And here's a good iron wedge. You'll need it for some of the bigger pieces. Good luck. I'll be around from time to time to see how you're doing."
With that, Mr. Hawkins left me to my task. I could see that someone had split some of the wood. A few cords of wood had already been stacked over on the side of the clearing. Fortunately, the wood had been cut in 2-foot lengths, so all I had to do was to split it so it would fit easily in wood-burning stoves and fireplaces. I had helped my dad cut wood, so I knew that a cord was 2 feet wide, 16 feet long, and 4 feet high. There were several types of wood, some aspen, some fir, but most was pine. I was glad that there wasn't any oak. It would have been a real pain to split because it is so hard. So I started, one log at a time. I was glad this was only going to be a half day. I could ease myself into the job. I thought that sore muscles would be my greatest concern, but I was wrong. Blisters in my hands proved to be the worst problem. The afternoon went quickly. I created a routine in which I chopped for a while and stacked for a while. Mercifully, the autumn sundown came early. I walked back toward the house and looked forward to dinner. Mr. Hawkins was seldom around, so I established my own routine in the days and weeks that followed. I took off Sundays, but otherwise worked from sunup to sundown 6 days a week. By the end of 4 weeks, the stack of split wood was already larger than the pile of logs. I was doing more than a cord per day. Mrs. Hawkins was very nice. She made wonderful meals. Breakfast was my favorite. She'd give me all the pancakes I wanted, several eggs, and a couple slices of bacon. I think she liked having me around, because Mr. Hawkins was often gone for a week at a time. I tried to think of her as my mother, but she was too young for that. I didn't dare think of her as a friend. Sometimes I thought about the story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife. I certainly didn't want to get into any trouble like that. After about 6 weeks, I decided to take a Saturday off and go to town. Mr. Hawkins was home that weekend, so I asked if I could have $20.
"Why, you could paint the whole town red with that much," he chided. "Here's 10. That should be enough to have some fun without getting into trouble."
I didn't want to be forward, so I accepted the $10. But I really wanted to send the money home to Mom and Dad. I hadn't had any contact with them since I went to work for Mr. Hawkins, and I wanted to surprise them with some money. The walk to town took half the morning, but it was a beautiful day with leaves turning color and the New Mexico sky as blue as Mom's eyes, so I didn't mind the long walk. The first thing I did when I got to town was to write a short letter to my folks back in Texas, telling them about my work. I knew they would be proud of me. I put the entire $10 in the envelope and bought a stamp with some of the money I had left over from Mom's silver dollars. I licked the envelope shut and mailed it at the post office. The rest of the day, I just wandered around and enjoyed looking in store windows. I bought a loaf of bread with the last of my silver dollar money, and then walked back toward the Hawkins Ranch. About 2 miles down the road, an old pickup truck stopped.
"Can you use a lift?"
the driver asked. "Sure," I replied. "I'm going to Jess Hawkins Ranch."
"To the Hawkins Ranch?"
the driver exclaimed.
"Hop in, young man. We need to have a talk."
I certainly couldn't understand what we had to talk about. I didn't even know this man, and he didn't know me. Nevertheless, I jumped into the truck.
"You don't know Jess Hawkins very well, do you?"
he began. Not really. But he gave me a good job, and his wife has fixed plenty of good meals for me," I exclaimed.
"Do you know that the last guy Jess hired just disappeared? Of course, hardly anybody knew he was out there, so he really wasn't missed. You see, Jess Hawkins is my brother-in-law. I know for a fact that he never paid anyone a penny for having his wood split. He does this every year. He gets some strong, innocent guy like you to come out and work, and then someday when the wood is all split, he picks an argument with the guy. Usually he claims that the guy has been fooling with Mrs. Hawkins. Then he forces the guy to walk out into the woods and shoots him."
I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Had I split all of this wood for nothing? The driver interrupted my thoughts with another question.
"How much wood do you still have to split?"
"I've stacked about 40 cords. There isn't much left to do."
"No, this couldn't be happening. What if I got killed? Mom and Dad were expecting me to come home with more than $200, and now I have nothing."
I felt like I was trapped again on the hand-pumped repair car, and the great black locomotive was bearing down on me.
"You'd better get out while you're alive. I'm going to the Hawkins house to see my sister tonight. I'll tell her to fix you a package of food. Jess gets real ugly with her, so she has to do whatever he says. She doesn't know what he does to his workers, but she knows he is mean. She'll give you whatever she can. But I know she has no money, so don't expect to be paid."
The driver seemed honest, and yet this could be a con game between brothers-in-law. Maybe they just wanted me to run away. They wouldn't have to pay me then. On the other hand, if he was telling the truth, I might get killed in my sleep. When we got back to the ranch, I decided to do some investigating before the sun set. I knew the trails in the forest around the woodpile fairly well. During rest periods, I would walk in the shade. One day, I had noticed the Hawkins dog digging behind a thicket and barking nervously. I decided to check out this spot. If the driver was telling the truth, this could be a shallow grave. Jess and his wife and her brother were all talking in the house, so I went for a walk. I took their dog with me. He seemed to sense what I was looking for. He led me to the same thicket. I didn't even have to dig. The dog had already done the work for me. There were pieces of a blue denim shirt and a well-worn glove showing above the dirt. It was obvious that other animals had been digging there and may have carried away the bones. It didn't matter. I had seen all I needed to see. This was my last night with Mr. Hawkins. I got back to my shed just in time for dinner. I could hardly eat. I was sitting across the table from a murderer, and I was scheduled to be his next victim. He laughed and made small talk like nothing was wrong, and Mrs. Hawkins served the food with her usual pleasant manner. I excused myself as soon as I finished dinner and started toward the kitchen door.
"Did you have a good time in town?" Mr. Hawkins asked. $10 can get you pretty far with a nice woman, can't it?" he laughed. "Say, I went out and took a look at the wood pile this afternoon. I noticed that you've just about finished. I think it's about time to give you what you deserve."
I didn't appreciate his tone of voice, nor his reference to giving money for a nice woman. I was certain he was setting me up for some argument about Mrs. Hawkins. When I got back to the shed, I found a pillowcase full of food and an envelope with $5 in it. There was a short note that read, "I'm sorry. You're a good man. You deserve better." There was no signature, but I knew it was from Mrs. Hawkins. Somehow she had managed to get out to the shed. I was angry, worried, and determined. I waited until all the lights went out in the house and then started walking toward the railroad tracks. I knew the train schedule by instinct. Every morning around 3 a.m. I had heard the train whistle far in the distance, and I knew a place where it slowed enough for me to jump on. I was heading home. Just the thought of all that work with no pay made me angry. I should have set the entire wood stack on fire. That would have been one way to get even. As I was wallowing in the darkness of that thought, the faint cry of a train whistle caught my ear. The train was pulling out of Albuquerque. I stumbled on. The slight glow of morning touched the sky, and in the distance, on a hill, I spotted the parallel tracks of the train. "I'll catch the train at that hill," I told myself, and began to run. The train would slow a bit as it climbed the hill. I got there with only a few minutes to spare. I waited behind a young pine tree until the engine had passed. The train company discouraged men from hitching a ride, so it wasn't wise to be too conspicuous. It wasn't exactly the safest way to travel. There were plenty of stories circulating about men who had slipped while boarding a moving train. Hobos relished the gory details of men being ground to hamburger. This wasn't exactly my lucky day. This train was only pulling flatbeds, and most of them were loaded. Flatbeds were easier to get onto, but they provided little protection from the elements. As they say, beggars can't be choosers, and once again I certainly was a beggar. As I had hoped, the train slowed because of the hill, but it didn't slow very much. This was going to be a challenge. I spotted my car about 100 yards before it reached me. I tied my pack over my shoulder. I would need both hands to grab the bulkhead of the flat car as it moved past. I started running parallel with the train, so the sudden acceleration wouldn't jerk my shoulders out of their sockets. There would be no second opportunity. Just as the bulkhead reached my shoulder, I sprang toward it. The next few seconds were a blur. When I regained my concentration, I was lying on the flatbed and my hair was whipping in the wind. I hadn't realized how cold the morning was until I found myself on the unprotected speeding train car. My tattered coat was now my only protection from the biting cold. By my calculation, we would reach Dalhart around sundown. At least I would not have to spend a cold night on the train. Mother always quoted the Bible passage, "All things work together for good for those who trust the Lord." This verse haunted me during the lonely hours on that train. What could possibly be good about my whole adventure in Albuquerque? All I had done was chop wood. On the other hand, I was stronger now. You can't swing an axe 8 hours a day for 6 weeks and not get stronger. I had a full beard now. There was no reason to shave, since I never went anywhere or met anyone. I knew a great deal more about myself and my body. It takes more than strength and endurance to get a job done. You have to use your body intelligently and efficiently. Let the axe do the work. Always keep your eye on the target. Take advantage of rhythm and flow. Don't fight the task. Bend with it. Maybe there was some good in all of this. I must have slept part of the day because the hours seemed to pass quickly. Toward sunset, I was seeing familiar territory. I started to think of home, of a warm meal, of loving embraces. But I also dreaded the questions. How did it go? Did you earn a lot? Did you make any interesting new friends? Those questions almost made me want to stay on the train. Perhaps that is what my hobo friend Mo had done. He just never went home. But no, I really wanted to go home, no matter what. We are a family, and we can always patch things up, just like my old coat, I reminded myself. I looked down at my hands. They were almost black with soot. 8 hours downwind from a billowing smokestack would turn almost anything black. My coat and pants were black. I wondered what my face looked like. I decided to use my dirty appearance to have some fun. Mom had poor eyesight, and I figured she wouldn't know my bearded face. My hair was pretty long, and I messed it up and let it hang down on the sides. My coat was still covered with soot. I decided to stoop a little and droop my shoulders so she wouldn't recognize my shape. I knocked on the screen door and moved back a step or two. Mom came to the door. She was beautiful in her cotton dress and apron. Her golden hair was pulled back and perfectly arranged in a braided crown. I wanted to hug her and say, "I'm home!" But this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to play a trick on her.
"Yeah? What do you want?" she said in a deep voice.
"Evening, ma'am," I said in the thickest southern drawl I could muster. "Can you spare a smidgen of coffee for a hungry stranger?"
I disguised my voice as much as possible, and the accent was sure to sidetrack her. Even though I had lived all my life in Oklahoma and Texas, I never picked up the local drawl. I suppose it was an indication of just how separate our German Mennonite community had been from the English speakers. Even with the drawl, I could see Mom catch a note of familiarity in my voice. She came a step closer and squinted. I stooped a bit more. She said,
"My man is out in the barn. He'll give you a cup of fresh milk, and when you get back, I'll have some warm roggebrot and a cup of prips for you."
"Thank you, ma'am," I said as I turned to the barn. I didn't want to carry this any further.
As I looked away, I straightened up and began to whistle the melody of Gott ist die Liebe. The tune was one of her favorites, and the words reminded her that we have a loving God.
"Peter, Peter, mein Peter!" she began crying as we rushed into each other's arms. She held me for a long time. Usually I felt uneasy if she held me very long, but today I wanted it to last as long as possible. Her arms wrapped around me like a warm winter coat.
Just then Dad came out of the barn with a full pail of foamy milk. He walked slowly at first, and then, when he figured out what was happening, he set down the bucket and ran to meet me.
He almost never hugged me, but this time it seemed right. It was more than a hug. It was love and forgiveness and respect.
Gott ist die Liebe, lässt mich erlösen. Gott ist die Liebe, liebt auch mich. Drum sag ich noch einmal, Gott ist die Liebe, Gott ist die Liebe, liebt auch mich. Ich lag in Banden der schweren Sünde. Ich lag in Banden und konnt nicht los. Drum sag ich noch einmal, Gott ist die Liebe, Gott ist die Liebe, liebt auch mich. Er sandte Jesu den treuen Heiland, er sandte Jesu und macht mich los. Drum sag ich noch einmal, die Liebe, liebt auch mich. Jesus, mein Heiland, gab sich zum Opfer. Jesus, mein Heiland, büßt meine Schuld. Drum sag ich noch einmal, Gott ist die Liebe, Gott ist die Liebe, liebt auch mich.
That was Larry Walkentine reading his story, A Coat of Many Patches. The whole mood of the story reminds us of a quote from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. His brow is wet with honest sweat. He earns whate'er he can, and looks the whole world in the face, for he owes not any man. As we heard on several occasions during this story, the narrator almost loses his life, like the time he and his dad were on that railroad bridge and had to jump off the hand cart, and of course at the conclusion, when our young hero might have been outright murdered after having split all that wood. And look, folks, I gotta tell you, having done quite a bit of wood splitting myself, the idea of splitting 50 cords of wood by hand is absolutely mind-boggling. Friends, Larry Walkentine was born in Reedley. His family has a long history dating back to the 16th century in the Mennonite Church. He graduated from Emmanuel High in Reedley, Tabor College in Kansas, and received a doctorate in musical arts from USC. He taught music at Fresno Pacific University for 40 years and also for a time wrote the classical music reviews for the Fresno Bee. He also composed a number of classical music pieces, some of which have actually been broadcast over KVPR. Thank you, Larry, for your fine story tonight. We hope you have another one for us for next year. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's story again, or for that matter, access any of the other programs in this series, just go to kvpr.org and click on Archived Audio. Next week, our writer reader will be Marilyn Larson. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a weekly series produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk for Valley Public Radio. Please join us again next Wednesday at the same time for another edition of Valley Writers Read.